It was a dark day, the air thick with brown fines, the winds high. Another dust storm, no doubt about it. Temperatures were plummeting. Sax sniffed at a radio voice which claimed the dust storm was going global. Michelle, however, was pleased. It meant they could travel during the day as well, cutting their travel time in half. We've got 5,000 kilometers to go, and most of it off-road. It will be wonderful to be able to travel by day. I haven't done that since the great storm. So he and Kasei began driving round the clock, taking shifts of 3 hours at the wheel, followed by a half hour off. Another day, and they were down the Compton Break and into tight-walled Ayas Chasma, and Michelle relaxed. Ayas was the narrowest of all the canyons in the Marineris system, only 25 kilometers wide when it left the Compton Break, dividing Sinai Plainum from Tithania Katina. The canyon was a deep slash between these two plateaus, its side cliffs a full 3 kilometers high, a long, narrow giant of a rift. But they only saw the walls in glimpses, through bubbles of open air in the blowing dust. They continued to follow a level but rock-strewn route, making good progress through all of a long, dim day. It was quiet in the car, the radio turned down to decrease the irritation of the static. The camera's views, higher than the windows, were of dust whipping past them so that it seemed they hardly moved. Often it looked as if they were slewing sideways. It was hard driving, and Simon and Sax spelled Michelle and Kasei, following their directions. Anne was still not talking, and they didn't ask her to drive. Sax drove with one eye on his AI screen, which was giving him atmospheric readouts. She could tell from across the car that the AI was indicating that the impact of Phobos was thickening the atmosphere a great deal, projected to as much as a 50 millibar addition, an extraordinary amount. And the newly smashed craters were still outgassing. Sax noted this change with his owlish satisfaction, oblivious to the death and destruction that came with it. He noticed her glare and said, "Like the Noachian Age, I suppose." He nearly added more, but Simon silenced him with a look and changed the subject. In the next car, Maya and Frank passed the hours by calling over and asking Michelle questions about the hidden colony, or discussing with Sax the physical changes occurring, or speculating about the war. Hashing it all over endlessly, trying to make sense of it, to figure out what had happened. Talking, talking, talking. On Judgment Day, Anne thought, as all the quick and the dead staggered around together, Maya and Frank would still be talking, trying to figure out what had happened, where they had gone wrong. Their third night out, the two cars ran down the lower end of Ayas and came to a long, lemniscate fin dividing the canyon. They followed the official Marineris Highway down the South Fork. In the last hour before dawn, they caught sight of some clouds overhead, and the dawn was much lighter than those of the previous days. It was enough to send them to cover, and they stopped in a fall of boulders stacked against the foot of the canyon's south wall and gathered in the lead car to wait out the day. Here they had a view out over the broad expanse of Melis Chasma, the biggest canyon of them all. Ayas's rock was rough and blackish in comparison to the smooth red floor of Melis. It seemed to Anne possible that the two canyons were made of rock from ancient tectonic plates, once moving past each other, now juxtaposed forever. They sat through a long day, talked out, tense, exhausted, their hair oily and uncombed, their faces grimy with the ubiquitous red fines of a dust storm. Sometimes there were clouds, sometimes haze, sometimes sudden pockets of clarity. In mid-afternoon, without any warning at all, the rover rocked on its shock absorbers. Startled to attention, they jerked up to look at the TVs. The rover's rear camera was pointed back up Ayas, and suddenly Sax tapped the screen displaying its view. "Frost," he said. "I wonder..." The camera showed the frost steam thickening, moving down canyon toward them. The highway was up on a bench above the main floor of Ayas's South Fork, and this was lucky because with a roar that shook the rover, That main floor disappeared, overwhelmed by a low wall of black water and dirty white mush. It was a juggernaut of ice chunks, tumbling rocks, foam, mud and water, a slurry throwing itself down the middle of the canyon. The roar was like thunder. Even inside the car it was too loud to talk, and the car trembled under them. Below their bench, the canyon floor proper was perhaps 15 kilometers across. The flood filled this whole expanse in a matter of minutes and promptly began to rise against a long talus slope that ran out from the cliff down canyon from them. The surface of the flood settled as it pooled against this dam and froze solid as they watched, a lumpy, discolored chaos of ice, strangely stilled. Now they could hear themselves shout over the cracks and booms and omnipresent roaring, but there was nothing to say. They only stared out the low windows or at the TVs, stunned. The frost steam coming off the flood surface lessened to a light fog, but no more than 15 minutes later, the ice lake burst at its lower end, rupturing in a surge of black steaming water that tore the talus dam away with an explosive roar of avalanching rock. The flood poured down canyon again, its leading edge beyond their view, down the great slope from Ayas to Melis Chasma. Now there was a river running down Valles Marineris, a broad, steaming, ice-choked deluge. Anne had seen videotape of the outbreaks in the north, but she hadn't been able to get to one to see it in person. Here in the flesh, she found it almost impossible to grasp. The landscape itself was now speaking a kind of glossolalia. The inchoate roar smashed at the air and quivered their stomachs like some base tearing of the world's fabric, and it was visual chaos as well. A meaningless jumble that she couldn't seem to focus on, to distinguish near from far, or vertical from horizontal, or moving from still, or light from dark. She was losing the ability to read meaning from her senses. Only with great difficulty could she understand her companions in the car. She wasn't sure if it was her hearing or not. She couldn't stand to look at Sax, but then Sax she at least understood. He was trying to hide it from her, but it was clear he was excited by what was happening. That calm, dead exterior had always masked a passionate nature, and she had always known it. Now he was high-colored as if he had a fever, and he never met her eye. He knew that she knew what he felt. She despised his shirking inability to confront her, even if it did arise from some kind of consideration for her. And the way he stayed always busy at his screen, he never actually looked out the low-floor windows of the rover to see the flood with his own eyes. "The cameras have a better view," he would say mildly when Michelle urged him to have a look. And after only a half hour of watching the first arrival of the flood on the TVs, he had gone to his AI screen to work out what it might mean to his project. Water rushing down Ayas, freezing, breaking up, and rushing down again. Certainly into Melis. Whether there would be enough water to make it into Caprades, and then down into Capri and Eos, and then down into the Orium Chaos, it seemed unlikely on the face of it. But the Compton Aquifer had been big. One of the biggest ever found. Marineris very likely owed its existence to outbreaks from earlier incarnations of the same aquifer, and the Tharsis Bulge had never stopped outgassing. She found she was lying on the floor of the rover, watching the flood, trying to comprehend it. She tried to calculate its flow in her head, just as a way to focus better on what she saw, to bring it back out of the meaninglessness that threatened to overwhelm her. Despite herself, she felt the fascination of the calculation and of the view, and even of the flood itself. This had happened on Mars before, billions of years ago, and probably just like this. There were signs of catastrophic floods all over, beach terraces, lemniscate islands, channel beds, scab lands, and the old broken aquifers had refilled from the Tharsis upwelling and all the heat and outgassing that that engendered. It would have been slow, but give it 2 billion years. She forced herself to focus, to see. The near edge of the flood was about a kilometer away and 200 meters below them. The foot of the northern wall of Ias was about 15 kilometers away, and the flood stretched right to it. The flood was perhaps 10 meters deep, judging by the giant boulders that rolled downstream like big man's bowling balls, smashing ice to shards and leaving steaming black polynyas in their wake. The water in the open patches seemed to be moving at perhaps 30 kilometers an hour, so, punching figures into her wrist pad, perhaps 4.5 million cubic meters per hour. That was about 100 Amazons out there, but running irregularly, freezing and bursting in a perpetual series of ice dams building and failing, whole steaming lakes leaping downhill over whatever channel or slope they found themselves on, stripping the land down to bedrock and then tearing the bedrock away. Lying on the floor of the rover, Anne could feel that assault in her cheekbones, vibrating the ground in a rapid pounding. Such tremors hadn't been felt on Mars in millions of years, which explained something else that she had seen but not been able to comprehend. The northern wall of Ias was moving. The rock of the cliffs was flaking off and falling into the canyon, which shook the ground and triggered more collapses and giant waves that washed out into the flood, water pouring back upstream over the ice, the rock bursting apart in explosions of hydration, the frost steam pouring so thickly into the dust-choked air that she could see the northern wall only in snatches. And without a doubt, the southern wall would be collapsing in a similar way, although their view of this wall, which loomed over their road to the right, was foreshortened and cut off. But it had to be falling. And if it flaked off above them, then they were dead for sure. It was quite possible, very possible. Judging by her glimpses of the north wall, the chances might be as high as 50%, but then it was probably worse over there. The northern wall appeared to be undercut by the flood, while the south wall was removed from it by the bench they were driving over, so the southern cliffs should be a bit more stable. But then something drew her eye forward, downstream from them. Up there, the south wall was indeed collapsing, falling in great sheets of rock. The base of the cliff exploded in a cloud of dust that bloomed over the talus, and the upper sections of the cliff slid down into this new cloud of dust and disappeared. After a second, the whole mass reappeared, flying horizontally out of the cloud, a strange sight. The noise was painfully loud, even inside the car. Then it was just a long, slow landslide, down into the flood, the rocks crushing the ice and blocking the flow beneath. An instant dam, cutting off much of the flow down canyon. And so the banks of the flood began to rise. Anne watched the icy sheet of the shoreline below her rupture, and then it was chunks of ice jostling in a sea of black, smoking, fizzing water, rising swiftly toward the rover. It would engulf them if the landslide dam lasted long enough. Anne peered at the long, black spill of rock ahead of them. Only a strip of it was still visible above the flood. But the slush beneath her continued to rise. It was a race of sorts. Big man's bathtub, draining while he poured new bucketfuls in. The speed of the lake's ascent caused Anne to raise her estimate of the flow rate. She felt paralyzed, disconnected, in some curious sense serene. It was a matter of indifference to her whether or not the dam broke before the flood reached them, and in the overwhelming roar she felt no need to communicate with the others about this. It was impossible. She found that in a way she was cheering the flood on. It would serve them all right. But then the landslide dam disappeared under the discolored slurry, and it all rolled off downstream in a stately collapse, the short-lived lake dropping as she watched, ice blocks on its surface clattering together, shrieking and booming as they collided and jumbled around and shot high into the air, all fantastically loud, every audible pitch roaring at once. It had to be well over 100 decibels. She had her fingers in her ears. The car was bouncing up and down. She could see more landslides from the cliffs farther downstream, no doubt undercut by the sudden surge of the flood. The tremors they caused were triggering further collapses until it looked like the whole canyon would fill. It seemed impossible in all the noise and vibration that their little cars would survive. The travelers clutch their chair arms or lay there on the floor like Anne, isolated by the roar, their veins pumping with an awful mix of ice and adrenaline. Even Anne, who didn't care, found her breath short and her muscles tensed against the kinetic assault. When they could hear each other's shouts again, they asked Anne what had happened. Dully, she stared out the window, ignoring them. Apparently, they were going to survive, for the moment at least. The flood surface was now the most shattered, chaotic terrain she had ever seen, the ice pulverized to a plain of wicked shards. The high point of the lake had climbed their bench until it had been only 100 meters downslope from them. The re-exposed wet ground down there had turned from rusty black to dirty white in less than 20 seconds. Freezing time on Mars. Sax had stayed in his seat through all that, absorbed by the flickering on his screen. A lot of water would evaporate, or rather freeze and sublime, he muttered to no one as he worked. It was a heavily carbonated saline brine, but it would end up as dust-filled snow falling somewhere else. The atmosphere might get hydrated enough so that it would snow several times, or even on a regular basis, in cycles of precipitation and sublimation. Thus, the flood water would get distributed pretty evenly planet-wide, except perhaps at the highest altitudes. Albedo would rise dramatically. They would have to lower it, presumably by encouraging the snow algae that the Acheron group had created. But there was no more Acheron, Anne said to him in her mind. Black ice would melt by day, then freeze at night, sublimate and precipitate. And thus they would have a waterscape. Streams collecting, pooling, running downstream, freezing and expanding in cracks in the rock, subliming and snowing and melting and running again. A glaciated or muddy world most of the time. But a waterscape, nevertheless. And every single feature of the primal Mars would melt away. Red Mars was gone. Anne lay there on the floor by the window. Her tears poured out of her to join the flood. Over the dam of her nose, downstream, until her right cheek and ear and the whole side of her face was wet. This will complicate the process of getting down canyon, Michelle said with a little Gallic smile, and from the next car, Frank laughed. In fact, it looked as if it would be impossible for them to proceed even 5 kilometers. Directly before them, the canyon highway was buried under the great landslide, completely gone. The new spill of rock was shattered and unstable, sapped from below by the flood, pounded from above by subsequent mass wasting of the new slope. For a long time, the others debated even making a try. They had to speak loudly to be heard over the jet engine roar of the flood, which still swept past with no sign of a let-up. Nadia considered the slope suicidal, but Michelle and Cassay were pretty sure they could find a way, and after a long day's reconnaissance on foot, they managed to convince Nadia to agree to try it, and the rest were willing if Nadia was. And so the day after that, protected from surveillance by the general dust storm and the flood's steam, they divided into the 2 cars and drove slowly out onto the slide. It was a rough mass of gravel and sand, liberally sprinkled with boulders. There was, however, a zone corresponding to the bench below it, which was relatively level. This zone was the only thing that made passage possible. It was a matter of finding an unobstructed way over a surface like poorly mixed cement, around boulders, and past the occasional gaping hole. Michelle drove the lead car boldly, with a stubbornness verging on the reckless. "Desperate measures," he declared cheerily. "Can you imagine getting on this kind of ground in the normal course of things? It would be insane." "It's insane now," Nadia said sourly. "Well, what can we do? We can't go back, and we can't give up. These are the times that try men's souls." "Women, however, do fine." "I was quoting. You know what I mean. There's simply no possibility of going back. The head of Ayas will be flooded wall to wall. I suppose it's this that makes me somehow happy. Have we ever been so free of choices? The past is wiped out. All that matters is now, the present and the future. And the future is this field of stones, and here we are. And, you know, you never really summon all of your strength until you know that there's no way back, no way to go but onward. And so onward they went. But Michelle's sanguinity was sharply reduced when the second car collapsed into a hole that had been concealed by a kind of trap-door arrangement of boulders. With some work, they were able to open the front lock and pull out Casey, Maya, Frank, and Nadia. But there was no chance whatsoever of freeing the second car. They didn't have the lift or the leverage. So they transferred all the supplies out of it until the lead car was absolutely stuffed. And they moved on. 8 of them and their supplies, all now in a single car. Beyond the landslide, however, it got easier. They followed the canyon highway down into Melis Chasma and found that the road had been built close to the south wall, and as Melis was such a broad canyon, the flood had had room to spread out and had bowed off some ways to the north. It still sounded like air miners were running at full capacity right outside their lock, but the road was well above and to the south of the flood, which was releasing veils of frost steam that filled the chasm and obscured any views farther north. So they proceeded without difficulty for a couple of nights, until they came to the Geneva Spur, which stuck out from the gigantic south wall nearly to the edge of the flood. Here the official road had swung out into what was now the course of the deluge, and they had to find a higher route. The rocky traverses they made around the lower slopes of the spur were really difficult for the rover. Once they were nearly hung up on an obtruding rounded rock, and Maya shouted at Michelle, accusing him of recklessness. She took over the driving, while Michelle and Casey and Nadia went out in walkers. They jacked them off the rock and then walked ahead to reconnoiter the route of the traverse. Frank and Simon helped Maya look for obstructions as she drove. Sax continued to spend all his time at his screen. From time to time, Frank would turn on the TV and run a search for signals, trying to piece together news from the occasional staticky voices the radio found in the jamming. On the very spine of the Geneva Spur, as they were crossing the absurdly thin concrete thread of the Trans Canyon Highway, they were far enough out from the south wall to get some transmissions, something about it not becoming a global dust storm after all. And indeed, the days were sometimes only hazy, rather than clotted with the dust. Sax claimed this as proof of the relative success of the dust-fixing strategies pursued since the Great Storm. No one responded to this. The haze that was in the air, Frank observed, seemed actually to help clarify weak radio signals. That was stochastic resonance, Sax said. The phenomenon was counterintuitive, and Frank questioned Sax closely for an explanation of it. When he understood, the room rang with his mirthless bray. Maybe all the emigration was stochastic resonance, enhancing the weak signal of the revolution. I don't think it helps to make analogies between the physical and social worlds, Sax said primly. Shut up, Sax. Go back to your virtual reality. Frank was still angry. Bitterness sublimed from him like the frost steam off the flood. He snapped questions at Michelle about the hidden colony, his curiosity bursting out 2 or 3 times a day. Anne was happy to think she would not be Hiroko when Frank first met her. Michelle answered these accusing questions calmly, ignoring the sarcasm and the furious gleam in Frank's eye. Maya's attempts to cool Frank only increased his rage, but she kept at it. Anne was impressed at how persistent she was, how insensitive to Frank's brusque rejections. It was a side of Maya that Anne had never seen before. Maya was usually the most volatile person around, but not now, not when the pressure was really on. Eventually they rounded the Geneva Spur and got back on the bench under the southern escarpment. The way east was often interrupted by landslides, but they always had room to veer left around them. Progress was good. But then they came to the eastern end of Melis. Here the greatest chasm of them all narrowed and dropped several hundred meters down into the two parallel canyons of Caprates, which were separated by a long, narrow plateau. South Caprates dead-ended in a cliffy headwall some 250 kilometers away. North Caprates connected with the lower canyons farther east, and therefore was the one they wanted to take. North Caprates was the longest single segment of the Marinara system. Michel called it La Manche, and like the English Channel, it narrowed as it progressed eastward, until at around 60 degrees longitude it narrowed and reared into a gigantic gorge. Sheer cliffs, 4 kilometers high, facing each other across a gap only 25 kilometers across. Michel called this gorge the Dover Gate. Apparently the cliff walls in this gap were whitish, or had been. So they made their way down North Caprates, and the cliffs closed in on them more every day. The flood filled almost the whole width of the canyon floor, and its flow was so rapid that the ice on its surface had broken into small bergs, which flew off the lips of standing waves and crashed back into the cascade. A furious whitewater rapid with the flow of 100 Amazons topped by icebergs. The canyon floor was being ripped away, torn free of its bed and rushing down in red jolts of water like massive pulses of rusty blood, as if the planet were bleeding to death. The noise was incredible, a roar so continuous and pervasive that it dulled thought and made talk almost impossible. They had to shout everything at the top of their lungs, which quickly reduced them to communicating only the basic necessities. But then there was a very basic necessity to shout about, for when they came to the Dover Gate, they found that the canyon floor was almost completely covered by the flood. Their bench below the southern wall of the gorge was no more than 2 kilometers wide and diminishing every minute. It seemed possible the whole bench might be torn away in a flash. Maya cried that it was too dangerous to go on and argued for a retreat. If they circled around and drove up to the dead end of South Caprates, she shouted, and managed to climb to the plateau above, then they could drive past the pits of Caprates and proceed onward to Orium. Michel shouted his insistence that they press forward and get through the gate on the bench. If we hurry, we can make it. We must try. And when Maya continued to protest, he added forcefully, "The head of South Caprates is steep. The car would never get up it. It's a cliff like these, and we don't have the supplies to add so many extra days to our trip. We can't go back." The insane roar of the flood was his only answer. They sat in the car in their separate thoughts, separated by the roar as if by many kilometers of space. Anne found herself wishing the bench would slide from under them, or a piece of the south wall fall onto them, and put an end to their indecision and to the awful, maddening noise. They drove on. Frank and Maya and Simon and Nadia stood behind Michel and Cassay, watching them drive. Sax sat at his screen, stretching like a cat, staring myopically at the little picture of the deluge. The surface calmed for a moment and froze over, and the explosive noise reduced to a violent, low rumble. "It's like the Grand Canyon on a kind of super-Himalayan scale," Sax said, apparently to himself, although only Anne would be able to hear him. "The Kala Gandaki Gorge is about 3 kilometers deep, isn't it? And Dalagiri and Annapurna only 40 or 50 kilometers apart, I think. Fill that with a flood like..." He failed to recall any comparable flood. "I wonder what all that water was doing so high on the Tharsis Bulge." Cracks like gunshots announced another surge. The white surface of the flood blew apart and tumbled downstream. White noise suddenly enveloped them, battening everything they said or thought, as if the universe were vibrating. A bass tuning fork. "Outgassing," Anne said. "Outgassing." Her mouth was stiff. She could feel in her face how long it had been since she had last spoken. "Tharsis rests on an upwelling of magma. Rock alone couldn't sustain the weight. The bulge would have subsided if it weren't being supported by an upwelling current in the mantle." "I thought there was no mantle." She could just hear him through the noise. "No, no." She didn't care if he could hear her or not. It's just slowed down. But currents are still there, and since the last great floods, they have refilled the high aquifers on Tharsis, and kept aquifers like Compton warm enough to stay liquid. Eventually, the hydrostatic pressures were extreme, but with less volcanism and fewer big meteor strikes, nothing set it off. It might have been full for a billion years. Do you think Phobos broke it open? Maybe. More likely a reactor meltdown. Did you know Compton was this big? Sax asked. Yes. I never heard of it. No. Anne stared at him. Had he heard her say that? He had. Concealing data. He was shocked, she could tell. He couldn't imagine any reason good enough to conceal data. Perhaps this was the root of their inability to understand each other. Value systems based on entirely different assumptions. Completely different kinds of science. He cleared his throat. Did you know it was liquid? I thought so, but now we know. Sax twitched and called up on his screen the image from the left side camera. Black fizzing water, gray debris, shattered ice, boulders like great tumbling dice, standing waves freezing in place, collapsing and sweeping away in clouds of frost steam. The noise had risen back to its crackling jet howl. I wouldn't have done it this way, Sax exclaimed. Anne stared at him. He steadfastly regarded the TV. I know, she said. And then she was tired of talk again, tired of its uselessness. It had never been any more than it was now. Whispers against the great roar of the world, half heard and less understood. They drove as quickly as they could through the Dover Gate, following the Calais ramp, as Michelle called their bench. Progress was nerve-wrackingly slow. It was a bitter struggle to get the rover over the rockfall covering this narrow terrace. Boulders were scattered everywhere, and the flood ate away at the land to their left, narrowing the bench at a perceptible rate. Landslides from the cliff walls fell ahead and behind them, and more than once individual rocks crashed into the car's roof, making them all jump. It was perfectly possible that a bigger rock would hit them and smash them like bugs without a single bit of warning. That possibility subdued them all, which was fine by Anne. Even Simon left her alone, throwing himself into the navigational effort and going out on scouting trips with Nadia or Frank or Cassay, happy, she thought, to have some excuse to get away from her. And why not? They bumped along at a couple kilometers per hour. They traveled through a night and then the following day, even though the haze had diminished to the point where it was possible they were visible from satellites. There was no other choice. And then finally, they were through the Dover Gate, and Caprades opened up again, giving them some leeway. The flood veered a few kilometers to the north. At dusk, they stopped the car. They had been driving for some 40 hours straight. They stood up and stretched, shuffled around, and then sat back down and ate a microwaved meal together. Maya, Simon, Michelle, and Cassay were in good spirits, cheerful to have gotten through the gate. Sax was the same as always. Nadia and Frank a bit less grim than usual. The surface of the flood was frozen over for the moment, and it was possible to speak without hurting one's throat and still be heard. And so they ate, concentrating on the small portions of food, talking in a desultory manner. Late in this quiet meal, Anne looked around curiously at her companions, suddenly awed by the spectacle of human adaptability. Here they were, eating their dinner, talking over the low boom from the north, in a perfect illusion of dining room conviviality. It might have been anywhere, anytime. And their tired faces bright with some collective success or merely with the pleasure of eating together, while just outside their chamber the broken world roared, and rockfall could annihilate them at any instant. And it came to her that the pleasure and stability of dining rooms had always occurred against such a backdrop, against the catastrophic background of universal chaos. Such moments of calm were things as fragile and transitory as soap bubbles, destined to burst almost as soon as they blew into existence. groups of friends, rooms, streets, years. None of them would last. The illusion of stability was created by a concerted effort to ignore the chaos they were embedded in. And so they ate and talked and enjoyed each other's company. This was the way it had been in the caves, on the savannah, in the tenements and the trenches and the cities huddling under bombardment. And so, in this moment of the storm, Anne Claiborne exerted herself. She stood up. She went to the table. She picked up Sax's plate, Sax, who had first drawn her out, and then Nadia's and Simon's. She carried the plates over to their little magnesium sink, and as she cleaned the dishes, she felt her stiff throat move. She croaked out her part of the conversation and helped, with her little strand, to weave the human illusion. "A stormy night," Michel said to her as he stood beside her drying plates, smiling. "A stormy night, indeed." The next morning she woke before the rest and looked at the faces of her sleeping companions, now revealed in the daylight to be utterly disheveled, grimy, puffy, black with frostnip, open-mouthed in the total sleep of exhaustion. They looked dead. And she had been no help to them. On the contrary, she had been a drag on the group. Every time they had come back in the car, they had had to step by the mad woman on the floor, lying there, refusing to speak, often crying, clearly in the throes of severe depression. Just what they had needed. Ashamed, she got up and quietly finished cleaning up the main room and the driver's area. And later that day, she took her turn driving the Rover, doing a 6-hour shift and ending up exhausted. But she got them well east of the Dover Gate. Their troubles, however, were not over. Caprades had opened up a bit, yes, and the south wall had for the most part held. But in this area there was a long ridge, now an island, running down the middle of the canyon, dividing it into north and south channels. And unfortunately the southern channel was lower than the northern one, so that the bulk of the flood was running down it and crowding them tight against the southern wall. Happily, the bench terrace gave them some 5 kilometers between the deluge and the wall proper. But with the flood so close on their left and the steep cliffs on their right, they never lost the sense of danger, and they had to raise their voices to talk at least half the time. The crackling roar of the surges seemed to invade their heads, making it harder than ever to concentrate or to pay attention, or, indeed, to think at all.